Sunday morning, March 11th, introduction to learning Mishnah and Talmud, and we are in Masechet Brachot, Chapter Bet, which is Perek Bet, Mishnah Gimel, the third Mishnah. Hakore et shma v'lo hishmiya la'ozno yatsa. Rabbi Yossi Omer lo yatsa. So first of all, just linguistically, I'll point out the way I pronounce the word that means ear, his ear. I pronounced it ozno, even though it's a kamatz, and you would have thought that in the Sfardi pronunciation it would be azno, but I pronounce it ozno, and that's a good opportunity for me to remind people that something that it's important to remind you of, is that in the Sfardi pronunciation, there are two different types of kamatzim, two different types of that kamatz. 95% of the cases, the pronunciation is a, in a Sfardi pronunciation, a. And that's what's called a kamatz gadol, a big kamatz, or a regular kamatz is a kamatz gadol. Ah, but there are certain cases, about 5% of the cases, 5%, which it's called a kamatz katan, a small kamatz, which has a different sound, has sound of O. And how do we know the difference? It's hard to know. But the rule is as follows. The rule is that a havara skua bilti mutemet, havara skua, havara is a syllable, a closed syllable, skua, sagur, a closed syllable, that's bilti, bilti means not, mutemet, from the language of tam, that's not accented. A closed, unaccented syllable, if it has a kamatz in it, it's a kamatz katan. And has a different pronunciation of O. How do I know if it's
closed?
Closed, unaccented. Closed. So what does I mean by closed? So if you look here, let's do it first in the abstract. A closed syllable is a syllable that ends with a consonant. Like if I say bat or cat, those one syllable words, they end with a consonant. That's a closed syllable. And it's very simple. A consonant is when you, in some way, touch the parts of your mouth, one to the other, top and the bottom. Whether it's lips or whether it's the teeth or whether it's the tongue to the top of the mouth. In a consonant, when you say a consonant, in some way you close your mouth. Whereas a vowel is when you let air through. So a closed syllable is one that ends with a consonant. Let's take a word like ozen. Actually, let's take a different example. Let's take a word like kos, right? All those one-syllable words usually end in a consonant, kos. Or take now the word sefer. Take the word sefer, right? Mm-hmm. So the first syllable is se, and the second is fer. Clearly, the first syllable ends with a vowel, se, open, and the second ends with a consonant, sefer. So,
but even if the second one didn't end in a consonant, it would still be closed because it's the end of a word, right?
No.
No?
If it ends with a vowel, then it's open. Like halachti. Or even a better example is katavta. You wrote katavta. Ends with a kalatz, actually.
Key for the meat.
Let's see. I don't have the keys with me. So you like a key to the... So I'll run and I'll leave that running.
Morning.
Anybody
enjoy
everybody
yesterday? Yes. Except for my weight this morning. My tummy this morning is a little bigger than it was yesterday.
A closed, unaccented syllable that has a kamatz in it. The kamatz is a kamatz katan, and it's pronounced differently. It's pronounced O. So this particular case, the word ozno, and you're debating, like, say, should I pronounce it azno or ozno? So the last syllable is clearly open. O ends with a vowel. The first syllable is clearly closed. Whether you'd pronounce it az or oz, it ends with the zayin. That closes it. So it's a closed syllable. Then I have to know if it's accented or not. So it's hard to know from looking at it, but if you know how to pronounce it, you know that most words in Hebrew, 90%, the end of the word is the accented one. And that's, if you don't know better, then that's the way you guess that the first syllable is not accented. That's true. So therefore, the first syllable, the Aleph Zayin, is closed and unaccented. And the rule is a closed, unaccented syllable that has a kamatz in it is a kamatz katan. So it becomes oz, no.
That's only Sephardi, you're saying.
Right. In the Ashkenazi pronunciation, both types of kamatzim get the same pronunciation, which is oz. Right. And I often point out a problem that many times in the States, you have people who know Ashkenazi Hebrew teaching bar mitzvah lessons, and the family wants the kid to pronounce Sephardi because that's what they're used to. So the kid learns the Sephardi consonants from his parents. They say a tough at the end of, not a suff, for example. But the kid never learns Sephardi vowels because from his teacher, he got to the kamatz, doesn't know the difference. Teacher doesn't know the difference. Teacher knows an Ashkenazi, no difference. Mm-hmm. So the kid ends up pronouncing the kamatz the way he's told the Sephardi pronounce it, ah, but he never learns the difference between a kamatz katan and a kamatz gadol, and all different types of perversions come out, which are none of them good. Hmm. None of them good.
Interesting.
And there's a lot of examples. There's like four or five cases in every Torah portion in which a bar mitzvah boy often makes a mistake because of this matter. Okay, so back to our subject. Hakore et shma velo hishmia loz no yatsa. So we know the source of that ruling. The Mishnah is codifying what the Midrash, and the Sifrei actually darshan out. That you saw the Midrash and the Sifrei. The Sifrei is the Midrash Halakha on the book of Bamidbar and on the book of Dvarim, and this is the one on Dvarim. See at the top of the page it says Sifrei on the right hand side, and the left hand side it says Ve'etchanan. It's from Parshat Etchanan, chapter Vav, and this is Piska, this is portion Lamed Aleph, section Lamed Aleph, that's written right at the top center of the page. And then in brackets I have there Shema Yisrael, that's the Dibur Matril. This is on the Shema in Dvarim Vav, and it says Mikan Amru, from here they said HaKore Kriyat Shema V'lo Hishmia La'ozno Lo Yatsa. In other words, that the word Shema is to be interpreted as meaning what?
You have to hear it.
That's, it means listen. Listen Yisrael. So you have to hear it. Ah, but we can ask a question. It says Shema Yisrael. It doesn't say Shema me, I, ani. It says Shema Yisrael. It's true that I'm one of Yisrael, so at least I have to hear it, but I think others have to hear it also. So why is the halakha that you have to be mashmiya la'ozno? It should be mashmiya to all the congregation. So the answer to that probably is that mashmiya la'ozno, make your own ear hear it, is the best litmus test we have for making it audible enough so others can hear it. In other words, the idea is that others can hear it. But how do I test that it's loud enough so others can hear it? At least, if I hear it, then it was audible that, in theory, others who are around me could hear it. But the halakha, according to the Midrash, is that Shema Yisrael is a mitzvah, and the mitzvah is mashmiya la'ozno, right? Mashmiya is the causative of Shema. Shema means listen. And mashmiya means cause to listen. It's the binyan, the hifil binyan, which is the causative. So it's telling you that you have to do this. And it's secondly telling you that if you didn't do it, lo yatsa. What I'm saying is that whenever I say concerning a halakha lo yatsa, I'm actually telling you two halachot. First, that lichatchila you have to do it. And bediavad, if you didn't do it, it didn't fulfill your obligation, and therefore you have to go back and do it again. There's one of the questions on the sheet. What's the implication of lo yatsa? The implication, the practical implication is that if you did it like this, then you have to go back and do it again. Okay. So we'll put that aside. The Midrash. So according to our Tanakhama, right, the unattributed opinion at the beginning of our Mishnah that says, I'm sorry, I got it right, it says yatsa. So he holds that Shema Yisrael is only lehatchila. That lehatchila, you're supposed to mashmiya la'ozno, but bediavad yatsa. I want to make it clear that when the Tanakhama says yatsa, he's telling you that you should have done it differently. But if you did it like this, b'diavad yatsa. Had the Tanakam held that even lahatchila you don't have to mashmi'a lo'oznu, no, he would have phrased it differently. Yatsa means you should have done differently, but if you did it wrong, in any case, yatsa. So there's agreement between the Tanakam and Rabbi Yossi that lechatchila you have to be mashmi'a lo'oznu. No. The machloket is only b'diavad. They have to go back and do it again. The Tanakhama says you don't have to go back and do it again. Yatsa. But Rabbi Yossi says it's even b'diavad. You have to go back and do it again. It didn't work. Lo yatsa. So Rabbi Yossi holds like the Midrash. It says lo yatsa. Tanakhama, for some reason, holds that it doesn't hold back your fulfillment of the mitzvah. I want to introduce another Aramaic word in this mix of l'hatchila and b'diavad and b'shat adchak. And the word is l'ikuva. L'ikuva is lamed, ayin, yud, chaf, vav, vet, aleph.
Two words or one word?
One word. I'll write it on the... I can't write it there. I can write it here. Likuva.
Likuva.
And ikuv means holding back or preventing. Leikuva, it prevents. And the way I use the word is as follows. That according to Rabbi Yossi, mashmi'a la'ozno is likuva. It prevents fulfilling the mitzvah. So let me use all our different technical jargon together. Says the Tanakhama that indeed lechatchila you have to be mashmi'a lo'ozno. But b'diavad yatsa, meaning b'diavad, mashmi'a lo'ozno is not le'ikuva. It doesn't prevent the fulfilling of the mitzvah. Whereas according to Rabbi Yossi, who says lo yatsa, it means that lechatchila you have to be mashmi'a lo'ozno. And b'diavad lo yatsa, b'diavad mashmi'a lo'ozno is le'ikuva. It prevents the fulfilling of the mitzvah. You didn't do it. You didn't do the mitzvah. So a certain mitzvah can...
Just say it once more.
According to Rabbi Yossi, if lo hishmi'a lo'ozno, then lo yatsa, meaning that hashma'a lo'ozno is le'ikuva. It's a necessary condition. Likuva means necessary condition without which the mitzvah is prevented from being fulfilled.
Okay.
Yes. Okay, so let's see. I guess what we can do now is go to question 9. I think we did all the first 8 questions. I'll give you a minute just to look at them and think if we... Is there anything that you want to ask there?
On number 9?
Before number 9, is there anything that you want to ask?
Okay, so what we were just speaking about, is that the answer to question 1, that is the expression yatsa, is that having to do with l'chat chilam b'diavad?
No. When I ask what's the full form of the phrase,
okay,
it's yatsa yedei chova, fulfilled or went out of the hands of obligation. Yatsa yedei chova. Should I write it down?
Mm-hmm.
Write it on the board.
I've asked you the same question.
Yatsa
yedei
chova. Yatsa yedei chova. And if my handwriting's unclear, just tell me and I'll fix it.
Yatsa yedei chova. Okay. Literally the hand, right?
Hand. Yedei is hands. Went forth of the hands of obligation.
That's
right. The hands of obligation were gripping you and you managed to break forth.
And lo yetzah is just lo yedei.
Lo yetzah yedei chova.
And there's the word chayav, that's when you're subject to a ruling.
Right.
You're obligated to do
something. Chova is an obligation. Hayav is the verb. He is obligated.
Uh-huh.
It's the same root. You're right. Same root.
So you could, is it, would it be, in effect, in this context, yotzi or yotza is to become free of? You say, you went, use the phrase went forth, but to be free of.
Yeah.
Of the hands of the obligation, so to speak.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
You've escaped from the shackles, from the grip of the obligation. Anything else there you want to talk about? Okay, so we'll go to number 9, which was, what might be the importance or the utility or the significance of the demand, lahashmiya, those know. There are different ways to look at it, but perhaps we'll hear what kind of significance might you see to that.
It makes you pay attention.
Makes you pay attention.
Be right. Aware, I have the same thing, just be aware of what you're about to do.
Not what you're about to, but what you're doing. Right. And notice that it actually has something to do with John Gray, with Rabbi John Gray, in the sense that the previous Mishnah said that first you should accept upon yourself the yoke of the kingdom of heaven, and then the yoke of mitzvot, means going from the inner to the outer. First the theory, the acceptance, the idea, the belief, the knowledge, and then the deed of taking upon yourself mitzvot. Now, when we're talking about the importance of mashmiya la'ozno, saying things out loud, you could say that since the purpose of saying it out loud is to make you pay attention, to make you aware, to wake you up, even one more step, the purpose of saying it out loud is to give it a reality so that it will more deeply affect you, so it will catch you, so it becomes like a deed. When you think something, it's a mental thought, right? That's a tautology. But when you say something, it has a reality in the physical world. And realities in the physical world affect us very deeply. When you hear yourself saying words, it's almost similar to hearing someone else saying words. You're teaching yourself something. You're reminding yourself of something. You're inculcating something, and it's going now from the outer world to the inner world, right? And the ideal state. I'll just tell you something that's interesting. I have a friend who's a teacher of mine who did his doctorate in Harvard on the effect in Judaism and the meaning in Judaism of reading out loud. Right? Everyone knows that in an academic library you're supposed to be quiet, and if you make a sound, you know, they throw you out. Whereas in a Beit Midrash, if you don't make a sound, they throw you out. Right? You have to make noise. And it's very noisy, and of course it's disturbing to some people, including me, if you're not used to it. But in any case, my friend wrote his whole doctorate on the cultural and religious significance of the Beit Midrash atmosphere, which you're told to make noise. And I can't summarize the whole doctorate in one word, one sentence, but what he basically wrote is that an academic atmosphere, everything stays in the mind. And it's an academic exercise, and knowledge is very important, but there's no necessary connection to the outside world. Whereas in a Jewish atmosphere, everything has to be externalized to teach you, and to... It's a paradigm, actually, of the whole meaning of the culture, is that things have outward significance, and it's we have to take the inner world and make it real, and then the outer world comes back into us and affects us in, again, this... dialectic relationship of inwardness and outwardness, but it really creates a whole different atmosphere of the meaning of learning when it's spoken out loud. And that's one aspect of mashmiya la'ozno. And remember, that aspect might be true even according to the Tanakam, who says yatzah, because yatzah is b'diavad, but lahadchila is supposed to be mashmiya la'ozno. You have to make it real, you have to make it significant, you have to make it speak to yourself and to the world. And that comes to the second point, which is remember what we learned 2 weeks ago and 3 weeks ago and 4 weeks ago about the rabbis making Shema into a communal statement, a communal activity, as opposed to Beit Shammai that had in the bedroom privately at your own pace, at your own leisure, your own time. Beit Hillel brings it into the synagogue, into the community, and makes it a public event that everyone does together. So mashmielos no is part of that. You're supposed to be making a statement to the community, and the community is making a statement back to you. The community is affirming in a very public fashion what's at the foundation of our belief system. And it can't just be a private thing. It has to be a very, very public thing. So make a lot of noise.
This is fascinating to me, what you're just telling about, that somebody would do a thesis on that premise.
Well, we were like engrossed in the conversation. We could have gone on. I mean, it's just a very interesting subject, I think. You know, that Saturday Night Live skit that guy used to sit in front of that mirror, do positive affirmations out loud, look at himself. I mean, that's basically what, you know, he's sort of saying. It's a positive affirmation. The other thing is, have you ever felt your tefillin while you're davening out loud? I mean, it vibrates, you know, through your skull. And so by emitting forth the words, you're bringing forth those sound waves into the world.
And just to, I don't know if there's any basis in this, but there are a lot of places where we say that actions are more important than deeds. We punish things that are, you know, that are in the Avera world. If you have to have done something, you have to have done something, not just thought something, to be punished, etc. And the actions count more.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They're more significant. Emphasis on action and some physical event. And part of the implication, it seems to me, is that although we recognize extremely fundamental to us is the idea that God and the spiritual force of the world, if I can say it that way, is without any physicality, yet we recognize, I think, that there's some sort of interface between physical and spiritual. What's that mean exactly? We don't know. I'm going to say I can't understand that. I don't think we are capable of understanding what that means, but we do have some level of belief that there's an interface somehow between physical and spiritual. They're not wholly separated. Therefore, even though it bothers me, noise, you know, speaking, you know, noise and studying and so on, it can be a connection to spirit, to God. It can be a connection to the spiritual forces. It can be the vibration of your tefillin can be important. We don't know. I mean, I'm just saying it's conceivable that that's a part of the connection that gets made. That's part of the interface.
Of course. It actually connects to something we talked about in our philosophy class that, just to tell you very briefly, one of the major conflicts between Jewish philosophy and Greek philosophy is in the answer to the question, who is man? What does it mean to be human? And that, of course, could be in many different levels, but one level is that, more or less, to be simplistic, in Greek philosophy, man is the mind. The body is not important. Ultimately, at the highest level, we're trying to repudiate the body and go beyond it. The bodily is animalistic. It's gross. It's physical. What's godlike, again, in Greek philosophy, being, again, simplistic, is the mind, the spiritual, that which is beyond the physical. And therefore, of course, to extrapolate, there's no reason to read out loud. Why involve your body in intellectual endeavor? Intellectual being on a higher level than anything physical. But in Jewish thought, man is not just the soul, not just the mind, not just the heart, but man, the body, is an essential part of who I am, part of the definition of what it means to be a human being. The body is as holy as the spirit. And therefore, my reading and my davening, my learning should involve not just my mind, but my lips and my body. And my tefillin should shake, and I should jump up and down. My body should be involved in my learning, because I believe that my learning is meant to affect the physical world. That's really significant. And for certain, if you get someone from a traditional Jewish upbringing, and he would come into Shari Tefillah for a morning davening and would hear silence, they're not davening. it has to be out loud. It has to be real. It has to create an atmosphere of mutual and harmonious pandemonium. In other words, even though everyone might be saying their prayers at a different time, and the Beit Midrash might be learning different things, but there is a certain orchestration there to the noise, and the noise has an effect. I just know, for example, I'll give you two examples. It happens to me all the time in Rosh Hashanah. On Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, if you're 2 miles, and I'm not exaggerating, 2 miles from Yeshivat Har Tzion, you can hear. You can hear the davening. And you can hear from it. You can hear from distance. Hey, Shmei, Rabam, Yivarak, the whole world vibrates.
Wow.
It's meaningful. And on a lower level, just during a normal day of learning, you come close to the Shiva from a certain direction, certain climactic conditions, and you hear a hum. And it's not a machine.
Which yeshiva?
Yeshiva Taratil. Any yeshiva. You hear a hum, and that's the sound of Torah. And it creates a certain atmosphere, a certain vibration.
So it's interesting. My thought, what you were saying before about spirituality, is that we begin our lives, Jewish males, begin our lives with a very physical act of Brit Milah as the beginning of a spiritual search. A very physical action begins our spiritual search.
Right.
Interesting.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, as
the brit is in the flesh.
Two things, right.
Or you say, Asher chatamta bibsarino, which you cut into our flesh. Indeed.
Not to just pile on and pile on, but I used to have the thought that the idea of that there's some significance or importance of swaying, etc., while you're davening is silly, in the sense that it's easy for us to say, and especially I'm going to say Americans, the American mental attitude, the modern view of God, to say God doesn't care, you know, about the, you know, are you swaying, as long as your thoughts in the right place. And yet, as I've developed my personal thought about this interface between the physical and the spiritual, maybe we don't. I've gotten more humble about what affects God, and I don't know. And maybe that's part of the interface of how prayer interacts with the spiritual world. Maybe you do have to be swaying, and I mean, I don't do it much, but I'm saying maybe. How do I know? We don't know how that interface works.
But isn't the swaying different? I see the swaying as something a little bit different than the vocalizing, to me anyway. Because the swaying, to me, is a device that an individual uses to try to get kavanah. But the words, to me, are something subtly different than that.
It's two different things.
I don't know. I'm saying I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm only noting that I'm less presumptuous in my own mind about whether some physical thing can affect God.
Or just affect myself.
Affect myself.
The idea is that the physical has a role to play, has a role to play in what you might think is only a purely kavanah mental.
I'm just observing that maybe, I don't know, that if we say there's an interface, that's just the way I think of it, between spirituality...
That's a very computer
and physical.
Out there, by the way.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, maybe there's something to it. I don't, you know, and so you just... Somehow physicality relates to spirituality, we think. Maybe that's a way. I'm only saying I've withdrawn my
judgment
of it. Yeah.
I'll add two things to that.
Your second term.
That's right.
That's what you've just declared.
That's right. He's ready.
I remember when you began your term, and you've softened. Very good. But I won't let that out of this conversation.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
So the Gemara says about Rabbi Akiva that he would begin davening on one side of the room and find himself on the other side of the room when he finished. That his body, his prayer would take his body and not just his soul to someplace else. Again, it's an interface between the spiritual and the physical. And if we're talking about personal confessions here, I have a certain dialectic. because when I daven out loud at Shari Tefillah, sometimes people tell me that it's disturbing them. I don't want to disturb anyone. And other people tell me that it causes a certain tension. And if that's true, then I don't want to disturb people. But on the other hand, I do have a point to make. It's not good that we're davening silently. It's not just a different custom. It's a very, very fundamental and logical point. And when a congregation develops or learns or somehow segues into a davening that's more vocal and more physical and more visceral, it affects the congregation in deep ways. Okay? So look what we got with that.
It's good stuff.
So now we go on to question 10. What is the meaning of Lo Dikdik Votioteha? And that means we should read further on in the Mishnah. The Mishnah says the third word of the second line, Kara Velo Dikdik Votioteha. He read, meaning he read Shema, Velo Dikdik Votioteha. And he wasn't precise in her letters. Rabbi Yossi Omer Yatsa, Rabbi Yehud Omer Lo Yatsa. So lo precise in her letters simply means that he didn't pronounce the words correctly. Left out a letter, slurred a letter. The commentators point out that when you have a word that ends with letter X and the next word begins with the same letter, sometimes there's a tendency to slur them. But no, you have to be middukdak. You have to be exacting, and the word has to end, and then the new word has to begin. So certainly you can't make a mistake, can't leave out a letter, but you can't even slur. You have to be very, very exact in her letters. And that brings us to question 11, which is simple. When Rabbi Yossi says, Rabbi Yossi says, Yatsa, what is he talking about? He's talking about this particular case. Rabbi Yehud and Rabbi Yossi, they're arguing, Yatsa, Lo Yatsa. And again, it's an argument, B'diyavad, Lechatchila. Of course, you have to be middakdek botiyoteach. But if you weren't, if you slurred one letter or missed one letter, Rabbi Yossi says Yatsa, Rabbi Yehuda says Lo Yatsa. And that was the answer to question 12, what's agreed upon by both opinions, that Lahatchila, question 12, you have to be middakdek botiyoteach. Right? And then I asked in question 13, what's the importance of this? And an easy answer is understanding. Right? You have to make sure that someone else who hears you, or you who hear yourself, have to hear words that make sense. And this, of course, actually goes back to the first part of the Mishnah about Mashmi'a La'uzno. In other words, what I want to say is that the question of do you have to be middakdek botiyoteach, do you not, really only has relevance if you are mashmi'a la'ozno. Only if there's something audible here, does it really make sense to ask, well, once it's audible, does it have to be midduyak? But if it's not audible, if just thinking something, what do you mean? Don't talk about making mistakes in letters or slurring letters if it's only a thought. So probably the second part of the Mishnah is based in some sense on the first part of the Mishnah. Only after you have the idea of Mashmi'a La'uzno can you go one step further and talk about the obligation of being middakdek botiyoteach. And if you again go into a traditional Beit Midrash and hear Kriyat Shema being said, there's a great emphasis on getting every letter exactly. And especially the Zion in the third paragraph of Kriyat Shema, which often gets blurred. So the halacha is you have to sit on the Zion. Let me just give an example. Asheratem zonim. Right? It's not sonim and it's not sonim, it's zonim. So in that Zion you often hear that there's great emphasis on the correctness of the letter.
I thought it was for tiz karu.
Also there, right? Laman tiz karu.
Right.
Right.
That's when Rabbi Wolk used to...
Yes.
Rabbi Wolk's style here was to start saying louder near the end because the chazan always waited for him to finish.
Yes.
That was the style. Rabbi Pearl's more treats himself more as part of the congregation and doesn't administer so much the pace of davening, or as Rabbi Wolf did, that was just his style. And so he would start the last sentences, he would say louder and louder, so the chazan would know where he was, you know.
Yeah, that's the way it's traditionally
done. And he would always emphasize the Zion.
What kind of pace did he have?
It was a moderate pace. It was not they're very different from what we do in terms of pace, but it was a pace that he thought was right for the congregation, whatever he felt was appropriate.
By the way, I noticed this Shabbat when Rabbi Pearl wasn't here, that Rabbi Pearl does an influence on the pace. I think it was about 15% quicker this Shabbat.
It depends who the... Yeah, it was faster, yeah.
Okay.
That's the biggest thing. It depends on who the...
Yeah.
But Rabbi Pearl's presence, to a certain degree, slows down who would want to go faster.
Guilt.
Okay. So, where were we? We were in question 14, which is what I was talking about, the relationship between Mashmiya La'ozno on the one hand, and to be Middakdek Botiyote on the other hand. Now, I could go a little bit further with this, in the connection between the first part of the Mishnah and the second part, the first part being Mashmiya La'ozno, the second part being Middakdek Botiyote, and we could say that only if you hold that Mashmiya La'ozno is Li'ikuva, then can you discuss the question, is Middakdek Otiyoteya Li'ikuva? If Mashmiya La'ozno is not Li'ikuva, if B'diavad you don't need it, then of course you don't need Middakdek Otiyoteya. But if you have a hard and fast condition that you can't fulfill the obligation without something audible, then the next stage is to ask, that's something audible, does it have to be comprehensible? Does it have to be without mistakes so it can be understood? And on that question, Rabbi Yossi says, Lo Yetzah. In other words, Rabbi Yossi says, it has to be Mashmiya La'ozno if it wasn't Lo Yetzah, but B'diavad, you don't have to be Middakdek Otiyoteya. Rabbi Yehuda goes one step further. Not only does it have to be Li'ikuva, Mashmiya La'ozno, it also has to be Middakdek Otiyoteya. And if it wasn't Lo Yetzah.
So is the halacha closer to Rabbi Yose?
The halacha is that actually latchila you have to be Mashmiya La'ozno, but B'diavad Yetzah. There's a discussion there that gets rather complicated.
But generally it sounds like it is closer to it is.
But in any case, what's important to know is that latchila you have to be Mashmiya La'ozno, and you have to be Middakdek Otiyoteya. But that's just latchila. What would happen b'diavad if you didn't? Right, there's a little discussion there. Okay. So now we get to the third part of the Mishnah.
So the implication, you're inferring that at least partly because the second discussion doesn't have a comment by the Tanakhama. You're sort of saying the Tanakhama doesn't have an opinion on the second question because... I guess. Is that...
Yeah. Okay. That's a good point. I didn't even realize that, but I think it makes sense. Yeah. So now we get to the third part of the Mishnah, which I'll read. Hakorela mafreya lo yatsa. And then the fourth part, kara v'ta'a yachzor lamakom shata'a. So it says, if you read it backwards or out of order, lo yetzah, and if you read and you made a mistake, you should return to the place of your mistake. And these two halachot apparently are connected. If you, akur lemafri, read it out of order. So there's three ways to read it out of order. The paragraphs could be out of order, right? Or the sentences can be out of order, or the words could be out of order. The fourth possibility is not a possibility. If you say the letter's out of order, that's already not, that's not reading it. So it's either the paragraphs, or the sentences, the psukim, or the words. So So let's think, which is it? Which of those three is it? Well, I can bring an argument in two different ways. I can say the context here is about the paragraphs, because the previous Mishnah talked about the different paragraphs of Shema and the order of them, right? So it could be that now, when it says a kreilam afreya, it means if you got the order wrong of the paragraphs, lo yatsa. But that's difficult, because you have to ask yourselves, why lo yatsa? If you said the three paragraphs, but that got them in the wrong order, I understand that the rabbi said to say them in a certain order, but if you didn't get that order, why should it be lo yatsa? You said the basic Shema that's mandated by the Torah. It's kind of hard to understand. So perhaps it goes deeper. It's not the paragraphs, perhaps it's the sentences. If you say the sentence out of order, lo yatsa, the words out of order, lo yatsa, I can understand, because then you're missing from the basic unit the Torah gives you of what it says in the Torah. And then we understand the relationship between hakor lamafreya, someone who read out of order, and karavita'a, someone who made a mistake. In other words, since the principles is, if you read it out of order, lo yatsa, therefore you've made a mistake. You left out a word, left out a pasuk. You can't go back and add it at the end. You have to go back to the place that you made the mistake and continue on from there so that it won't be a reading of lamafreya. In other words, karavita'a, you should return to the place you made a mistake. That's simply a way of not getting yourself into the problem of kore lamafreya. Should I say that again? Okay, what else do we want to talk about here? Yeah, let's just talk about questions 19 and 20. 19 and 20 are the structure of the Mishnah. Here you come to something very interesting, which you probably didn't notice. It's really hard to notice. We look at the overall structure of the Mishnah. Okay, going back to the Mishnah. The first word is HaKore, the reader, or he who reads. And to use non-exact grammatical terminology, that's a present tense verb, Kore. Right, like kotev.
Present participle, right?
Right, the better way to say it is present participle. But people don't know participles, so they say present tense. But it's a present participle, hakore. Hakore et shema velo ishmi elos no yatsa. Rav Yosef me lo yatsa. And now look at the second part of the Mishnah, kara. It doesn't say what it could have said, hakore. It could have said, hakore et shema velo dikdek. But no, it says kara. It uses, for some reason, now a past tense. So the first part of the Mishnah about Mashmi Elos No begins Ha Kore. The second part that talks about being exact in the letters begins with the past tense, for some reason, Kara. Okay. The third part of the Mishnah, in the middle of the third line, Ha Kore Lemafreya. For some reason, it goes back now to the present participle. Okay. And then, the last word of the third line, kara, vita'a, it goes back to the past tense. So the order is, the Mishnah has four sections. And the order is hakore, kara, hakore, kara. Did you say that again?
No. I was just trying to think about the rules of present participle. I thought a lot of times it was with a mem, makes it a, putting a mem.
It's in a different binyan.
Different binyan. Maybe this...
Right. Just for example, the present participle... Yeah. But in this particular form, kore is present, kara is past tense. So it's hakore, kara, hakore, kara. Four parts of the Mishnah, and they don't all begin in the same fashion. So if we ask ourselves why, it's probably very clear. It's 1A, 1B, 2A, 2B. In other words, HaKore is indicative of a new section, whereas Kara is a subset of that section. So HaKore Shema V'lo Yishmi Elos No. And then kara velo dikdek is a subset of that. And as we said earlier, the matter of being exact in letters is dependent upon how you hold in the matter of mashmiya lozno. And in the third part of the Mishnah, hakore lemafred, it's a new idea. It's a new section. And then kara vita is a subset of that. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. So now we can have, I don't know if you have 5 minutes left or no minutes left. I wasn't looking at my watch. Probably no minutes left, right?
It's about 11.
Oh, it's only 11 o'clock?
Yeah.
Oh.
By my watch.
So we have a good 10 minutes.
Yeah, really? Well, the class ends at 11.
11:15, you said 11:10.
11:15.
So we have time to do the Tosefta.
Mm-hmm.
So the Tosefta, to say this shortly and clearly, so as follows. Okay, so as follows. The basic building block of Torah Sheba'al Peh is Midrash. Right? Midrash is when the rabbis ask a question on the Torah and give an answer. Midrash is made up of verse, question, answer, verse, question, answer, verse, question, answer. Right? A Midrash Halacha would be, why does it say in this week's Torah portion about Shabbat, why does it say, Lo tivaru esh b'chol moshvotechem, don't make a fire in all your dwellings? That's only one of the 39 melachot. Why mention one and not the others? That's a halachic question. The Midrash gives a halachic answer. Or you might have a Midrash Agadah. Why does the Torah not tell why Avraham Avinu was chosen? And it gives a certain answer to that question. So there's Midrash Halacha, there's Midrash Agadah. We're going to talk now just about Halacha. So the building blocks of Halacha are Midrash. Midrash, as we said, is verse, question, answer, etc. When someplace, probably around the Hasmonean period, like 200 years, 150 years before the Common Era, Chazal started to organize Torah Sheba'al Peh, they took the conclusions of Midrash, verse, question, answer, took the conclusions, the answers, and organized them in some places according to topic. So you just have answers, just have apodictic statements. Do this, do that, don't do this, don't do that. And that form of writing Torah Sheba'al Peh, of just answers, is called Mishnah. It's the form of writing it, the Mishnaic form. Now, from the time they began to organize Torah Sheba'al Peh in Mishnaic form, you have hundreds and thousands of little statements of halakha that are organized in different fashions, in different Bate Midrash. And all of these little statements of halakha are called braitot. They weren't then called braitot, we later called them braitot. What happens about the year 200 of the Common Era is that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi edits the Mishnah, like with a capital M, the Mishnah, which means that he takes all the Mishnaic material, all the apodictic material that just answers, and he organizes it by the topic, creates a text that's the basic authoritative text of Jewish law, and anything that's left out of that is called Breitut, which means external. And Breitut, we can divide into two types. The Breitut that are in Midrashic form, verse, question, answer, and the Breitut that are in Mishnaic form, just answer, 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 answer. So all that material, all of the Breita, is now floating around after the Mishnah was compiled, and there were different texts that organized some of the Breitot into secondary texts that are below authority vis-a-vis the Mishnah. And one of the major texts that organizes some of the Breitot is called the Tosefta. It means addition. It's organized on the basis of the same starim and the same sechtot and sometimes the same prakim as the Mishnah, but with different material there. Though sometimes you have a parallel. The Perek Aleph in Masechet Brachot of the Tosefta parallels Perek Aleph of Masechet Brachot in the Mishnah. It's additional material that wasn't included in the Mishnah. Sometimes the Prakim are not parable. You have to search a little bit. But in any case, here we have the Tosefta in Perek Bet of Masechet Brachot. And there's material that could have been included in our Mishnah, but it wasn't. It's secondary. It's perhaps opinions that are not accepted, or it's more lengthy than Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi wanted to include. Here we go. So this is Tosefta Brachot, Perek Bet, and it's Halacha 13. And within Halacha 13, I have a bracket. If you want me to repeat anything later, I can. So it says, Amar Rebbe Meir, and the resh is missing because this is simply reprinted from a certain manuscript, and the modern way of doing it is getting it exactly what the manuscript says, not adding anything. So it's just printed what the manuscript says. In those days, of course, they used to save ink by leaving out letters. Amar Rebbe Meir, Pamachat Hainu Yoshvin Beveit HaMidrash Lifnei Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva, I should say, but in Dallas I say Akiva because that's what the school calls itself. So said Rabbi Meir, once upon a time, right, Pamachat, one time, Hainu, we were Yoshvin Beveit HaMidrash. We were sitting in the Beit Midrash, and that's an Aramaic form, Yoshvin instead of Yoshvim. We were Yoshvin Beveit HaMidrash Lifnei Rabbi Akiva. So we were sitting in the Beit Midrash in front of Rabbi Akiva. He was teaching us. Vainu Korin et Shema, and we were reading the Shema. Again, Aramaic form, Korin. V'lo hainu mashmi'in la'ozneinu, and we weren't letting it heard to our ears. Mipnei kastur echad, because of a certain kastur. I'll go back to that word. Shaya omed ala petach, who was standing on the door. There was a guard standing at the door, and because of him, we didn't mashmi'a la'ozno when we said Shema. Amrulo, they said to him, Ein shat sakana ra'aya. They said to him, the time of danger, the hour of danger, is not a proof. So you have to figure out what's going on here. Anyone have any inkling what's going on?
Mm-mm.
So then let me give you a hint with that one word.
Illegal.
What?
It's illegal.
It's illegal, right. It's illegal to say Shema. So who is this Kastur? So Kastur, I did some research on this. It's a corruption of a Greek word, Kastur. Because the Dalid takes the place of what in Greek is a Tush sound. It's a Kastur.
Tau.
Kastur.
Tau, right?
Say it again?
The Greek letter Tau, right?
I never learned it, but is it? That's what it is?
I think so.
Okay. So what is the word Kastur? It's the same word in Spanish and English as conquistador.
Oh.
A soldier.
Oh.
Right. I wonder if constable comes from the same word. No, doesn't sound too similar. Anyway, a castor is a soldier. And this is a corrupted Greek word. So there's a soldier who's at the door and says, Rabbi Meir, we didn't mashmi'a la'ozno, or ozneinu, our ears, because of the soldier that was at the door. And why was the soldier at the door? Because it was forbidden to say Shema. And he was making sure they didn't say it. So they didn't say it out loud. They said it without saying it.
Hafacha. That last word is door?
Petach.
Petach.
The opening.
The opening, okay.
So again, Rabbi Meir now is in the Beit Midrash, and he's telling this story of what once happened to his colleagues. He's saying, once upon a time, I was in the Beit Midrash with Rabbi Akiva, and because of a soldier at the door, we didn't say the Shema out loud. We said it silently. And then, after Rabbi Meir tells this story to his colleagues in the Beit Midrash, his colleagues say back to him, this is the last seven words, they say to him, Amrulo, Ein Shat Sakana Raya. Is not the hour of danger a proof? The hour of danger is not a proof.
No, is not.
A proof.
In proving.
It's not a proof.
A proof?
Okay.
It's not a proof. Proof.
As in proof.
Proving.
A proof. Okay.
So now we have to extrapolate. If Rabbi Meir's colleagues tell him that Shat Sakana, the time of danger, is not a proof, what do you think Rabbi Meir was trying to prove that his colleagues told him you can't prove?
He was trying to prove that it's okay to say it quietly.
Right. Right. There's a discussion in the Beit Midrash, and there's an argument. Are you allowed to say Shema? I should say B'diavad. There's an argument. B'diavad, are you Yotze? If you say Shema without being mashmi'a lozno, or are you not Yotze? Rav Meir said, I can prove to you that you're Yotze. Because I was once with the great Rabbi Akiva, and we said Shema quietly. We didn't say it, Mashmiya Lo Zno, because there was a soldier at the door. The colleagues of Rav Meir said to him, what do you mean? That's no proof. What you did is not the right way to do things. That's just, there was a soldier at the door. It was a Shat Sakana. It was Shat Shema. It was a religious persecution. Had he not been at the door, Rabbi Akiva certainly would have told you that you have to say it in the fashion of Mashmiya Lo Zno. Right? So first of all, let's just give some historical background. This is the Adrianic persecutions, and English say the Hadrianic persecutions, right, which they don't know, historians don't know if it's before or after the Bar Kokhba revolt, but it's either right before, and it's the reason the revolt broke out, it was 131 of the Common Era, or it's the punishment that Hadrian inflicted upon the Jewish people for the revolt, which means it's after 134, the revolt was 3 years. Whatever it is, it's a period of serious, serious persecution for the Jewish people. At certain points we know that Brit Milah was forbidden, Talmud Torah was forbidden, certain things was only Shema was forbidden. Right, that's the reason today we say in Musaf, when we say the Chazarat HaShatz, repetition, and we add into Kiddushah, Shema, we add it in, because that's when the Kastur had already left the synagogue. He was listening to see if they say Shema for Shachrit. So he left when the Zman for Shema finished. It was no longer Zman Kriyat Shema. So then the Jewish people added it in, at least to say it, even though it was after the time. Kadam HaKoreh B'Torah, like we learned in the Mishnah 5 weeks ago, you can say Shema Kadam HaKoreh B'Torah. It's better than nothing. So anyway, now we have to ask ourselves a very, very serious question, which is, what was Rabbi Meir thinking? Didn't he know you can't prove anything from a time that your life is in danger? Right? Any halakha you can violate to save your life. So it could very well be that Rabbi Meir's colleagues are right. Of course you have to say Shema Mashmiya Lo Zno. Why didn't Rabbi Akiva say it like that? Because it was a Shat Sakana. Rabbi Akiva was simply protecting his life. And how did Rabbi Meir think to bring a proof that you can say Shema without any audible sound from behavior that happened under the wary eyes of a kastor? You hear my question? Mm-hmm. What's Rabbi Meir thinking? So it's a very good question. It's really buts, but I have an answer. I'm so happy I have an answer. And the answer is in a story that's told in the Gemara about this time of persecution. And it's the end of Masechet. The end of Masechet Brachot, and the truth is I only made three copies, so I wasn't planning to do this out, so just share. And it's in my bracket there. And it goes like this. Do you see my bracket? Tana Rabbanan. Pam echat gazra malchuta risha'a shelo yasku Yisrael b'Torah. One time decreed the evil kingdom that will not engage the Jewish people in Torah. Ba papus ben Yehuda umatzao l'Rabbi Akiva shayam makhil kehilot b'rabim vosek b'Torah. Came papus ben Yehuda and found Rabbi Akiva that he was gathering gatherings in public and teaching Torah. Amale, he said to him, Akiva, Akiva, aren't you afraid because of the kingdom? That's the, in other words, the decrees. Amalu, he said to him, I will make a parable for you. What is the matter similar? It's like a fox that was walking on the bank of the river. And he saw fish that were darting and gathering from place to place. Amar lehem, the fox said to the fish, Mipnei ma atem borchim, from what are you fleeing? Amrula, they said to him, Pnei rishatot shemivim aleinu b'nei adam. We, because of the nets that are brought upon us by human beings. Amar lehem, birtzonchem shetalu liyabasha, venador ani v'atem, kashem shedaru avotayim avotechem. So the fox said to the fish, is it your will, do you want to come up to the land and we will live, me and you, just as lived our forefathers with your forefathers? Amrulo, the fish said to the fox, Ata hu shomrim alecha pikeach Shebachayot, is it you that they say upon you that you are the cleverest of the animals? Lo pikeach ata eliti peshata. You are not clever, you are an idiot. Uma b'makom hayutenu anu mityarim. And what in a place of our life force are we afraid? B'makom mitatenu ala had kama v'chama. In a place of our death, of course we'll be afraid. Afanachnu, so we, says Rabbi Akiva, Akshav shana yoshvim voskim b'Torah, now that we are sitting and engaging in Torah, Shekatuba, that it says concerning it, ki hu chayecha v'orachimecha, that it's your life and length of your days, kach, we are suffering from the Romans, imanu cholchim u'mivatlim imena alat kama v'chama, if we go and nullify Torah, all the more so we'll be afraid of the Romans. So, of course, it's an important story to think about, but the point is that Rabbi Akiva didn't hold that you're allowed to be mevatel Torah in the face of the Roman persecutions. He didn't hold pikuach nefesh here, because he held the opposite. It's pikuach nefesh for Am Yisrael to keep learning. Mm-hmm. So that explains our question. Rabbi Meir knew that Rabbi Akiva did everything as normal, even under the watchful guise of the Romans. So if Rabbi Akiva was willing to say Shema quietly, without Mashmil Lozno, under the guise of the Roman soldier, that means Rabbi Akiva felt that that's the way he can fulfill the halakha, because he wouldn't have bent. He would have been willing to be arrested and be killed, as in the end he was, and he wouldn't have violated Torah. So that's the answer to the question. So it turns out that Rabbi Meir's colleagues were answering l'shitatam, but not l'shitat Rabbi Akiva. When his colleagues said, Ein shata sakana raya, the hour of danger is no proof, they were right, according to their own approach, that an hour of danger allowed to bend the halakha. But they weren't right, according to Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva really was doing what he believed was the only, I'm sorry, Rabbi Akiva did what he believed could be done even at a regular time. It's not shata sakana, not an hour of danger. So Rabbi Akiva, apparently, at least the way Rabbi Meir remembers it, was willing to say he held that Mashmiel Lozno is not li'ikuva. It's not, doesn't prevent you from filling the mitzvah. Probably lahatchila, Rabbi Akiva would say it out loud. But the fact that he's willing to say it quietly in the face of the soldier means he really felt that that's the way you can fill the halakha, because he wouldn't have bent just for the Roman gzerot, just for the Roman edicts. That's really, I think, interesting. And then we'll just finish up with the rest of the Tosefta that I brought at the bottom of the page. And just so here I photostated from the beginning of the same chapter of the Tosefta, which really doesn't add anything. Just show you how the Tosefta brings information. We already saw in our Mishnah. It says in Halakha 4, Hakore et shma v'ta'a v'hishmit ba pesuk echad. He who reads the shma and made a mistake and omitted in it one verse. So here you see how the Tosefta has the same words as the Mishnah, but also adds information. It explains, what does it mean, how the reader of the shma and made a mistake? It means hishmit ba pasuk echad. He omitted from it one verse. So really, our Mishnah and the Tosefta are parallel, but the Tosefta has just a few more words that explain. And for some reason, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, when he edited the Mishnah, left those words out, because he thought we understood. And what's the halakha? Now the last two words of the line. Lo yachzor v'yikra oto ha-pasuk b'fnei atzmo. He shouldn't go back, he shouldn't repeat himself, and read that verse itself. Don't, no, at the end of the Shema, don't add that verse. But what do you have to do? Ella matril b'oto ha-pasuk v'gomer. Rather, begin from that verse and finish. You have to go back to where you left the pasuk off and read on from there, so you read it in order. So now we'll just read Halakha 5 in the next brackets. Hakore et Shema v'ta'a. The reader of the Shema v'ta'a, and he made a mistake. Veino yodea heichan tan. He doesn't know where he made a mistake. You suddenly find yourself lost. You don't know where you are in the Shema, which unfortunately happens. Yechzur l'rosha. He will return to the beginning. You don't know where you are. You have to return to the beginning and now get it right. Ta'a be'emtza haperek. If you made a mistake in the middle of the perek, in other words, you know one of the three paragraphs you're in, but you don't know where you are in that paragraph. So what do you do? Yechzur l'rosh haperek. Return to the beginning of the perek. And now the last line of Halakha 5, which is the second last line on this page. Ta'a ben tiva rishana lektiva achona. He's mistaken between the first writing and the second writing. What does that mean? It means that at the end of the first paragraph of Shema, it says uchtav tam. And it says the same word at the end of the second paragraph of Shema. Ktiva, writing. So if you're saying Shema and you suddenly hear yourself say the word uktav tam, but you don't know, you suddenly forget, are you at the end of the first paragraph or the end of the second paragraph? What do you do? The answer is, yachzor l'ktiva rishana, return to the first writing. Return to the first place that it says uktav tam and go on from there, because there's no harm in saying Shema again, but there is harm in skipping. Okay? That's it.
Thank you very much.
That's a card, yeah. Okay.